Father Zeus, believing that the deathless gods will not violate his strict decree to not interfere with the Trojan War, turns his attention a world away to the land of the Thracian horsemen. Poseidon seizes this opportunity to help the Achaeans. He blesses the Aeantes and whips up the fighting strength of the whole Argive army. Battalions are formed around the two Ajaxes, and they war against Hector and his Trojans. Meanwhile, the two Achaeans, Idomeneus and Meriones, rush to the left flank, where the Argives are suffering the most. Poseidon continues to secretly war against the will of Zeus by spurring on the Achaeans against the Trojans. Idomeneus, the Achaean, crushes the Trojan Asius and Alcathous. And on the left flank, I'll get it.
Here we go. You're good.
In return, Aeneas, the son of Aphrodite, arrives to bolster the Trojans, and both sides clash around the corpse of the Trojan Alcathous. Menelaus, the Spartan king, squares off with Helenus, the Trojan prophet. Helenus' arrow bounces off the Achaean warlord's breastplate, but Menelaus' spear goes through Helenus' fist, and the Trojan companions drag him away from the battlefield for care. While the Argives hold the left flank, Hector, favored by Zeus, continues to collide against the Achaeans, blessed by Poseidon, back where Hector smashed the gate. Polydamas advises Hector to regroup, warning Hector that he has been blessed by fighting power, but not necessarily with tactics. Hector listens this time, and he goes to recall his warlords. Hector finds Paris and the carnage that the Trojans suffered on the left flank. The two princes rejoin the main force at the broken gate, but the Achaeans are immovable under the leadership of giant Ajax. Ajax taunts Hector that the Trojans will be forced to retreat soon, and a bird omen appears to confirm his words. Hector returns the taunt, and both sides prepare for another Trojan charge.
Welcome to the Saying the Great Books podcast. I'm Adam Minahan here with Deacon Garlic. We have a good friend returning again, Thomas Lackey. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Deacon, I got to tell you, I am so glad that you read that intro and not me. We would have spent the entire time me trying to figure out how to even pronounce a third of those names, much less all of those names. We asked the guys what they didn't like, or did we actually ask you what you didn't like about the so far? I think we did. We asked, or at least David gave some.
It naturally came up, I think, a few times.
What we didn't like about the book. What I don't like about the book thus far is that there'll be characters that are just thrown in there that you have no idea how to pronounce their names. You try to do the due diligence of like, okay, who is this person? You're trying to track them, trying to track the story. How do they fit in?
And then he's dead.
By the time you freaking figure out who he is or how to pronounce his name, he's already dead.
And I think this one, I'll be honest with you, I think this has been my least favorite book.
Book 13?
I think it's my least favorite. I don't add that with like a ton of gravity, as in like I hate this book, because I've actually greatly enjoyed reading the Iliad.
You're not sealing the...
Oh yeah, we should just slightly mentioned, he who we do not name in our Sunday Great Books has elected that he has sealed his hatred for Hector, and has decided that he hates Hector, and now we'll spend the entire rest of the Iliad hating Hector in our small group. So, no, it doesn't really elicit that strong of emotion from me in general.
Okay.
But I think that I was wondering, because I had to read several of these passages again. Like, I had to read them multiple times, and I'm not sure how much I thought it moved the narrative forward. I mean, I'm happy to be critiqued on this. I could have just been had an off day, and it just wasn't doing it for me. One of the other things, too, though, kind of what reminded me of it because of your critique of the names, was simply because all the Achaean warlords, the main ones, are injured, right?
Yeah, there's like...
And we have a main battle going on, really, with Hector and the two Ajaxes, but then we also have, we're also called the Aeantes, right? But then we also have this kind of left flank battle going on as well. There's like this host of kind of like tertiary characters that come forward that you're not used to seeing. And so I just really had to pay attention to like, wait, who is this guy?
What like, side is he on?
What side is he on? There's multiple A names that come up, and so just tracking those. So it's probably just laziness on my part, but it was a book that I somewhat struggled with.
What were your initial thoughts, Thomas?
I don't think that this is quite as rich as some of the other books. There are still things to be drawn out here, I think, particularly around the role of Poseidon.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think this would be at my very top. That said, I think that obviously it's all rich, but not maybe quite as much as book 12.
Well, Fagel's really kind of set us up for disappointment then, because you know he makes all the titles of each book, and this one's like battling for the ships, and you're like, all right, good, this is gonna be like epic. I mean, there's obviously
someone is finally going to set one of these hulls on fire,
right? And right? Now we're gonna move this thing forward. Anyway,
so let's pivot off of that, Thomas. So where do you see kind of Poseidon at the beginning of this?
Well, strictly speaking, we start off with Zeus ceasing to pay attention, and which provides an opening for Poseidon to sneak in. Although it's not much of a sneak, really. He starts striding with enormous footsteps towards the Argive. It's just that Zeus is not paying attention anymore. I think the first thing that caught me about the earth shaking under his immortal feet, you know, this sort of, it's a grand entrance for someone who's sort of, again, sneaking. The second would be, this might just come up later, but we see an example where he takes three strides and then a fourth. And I only bring that up because I forget exactly which books have what, to be honest, I'll just say that. But the three and then four seems to be an interesting...
That's a pattern we'll see later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember what line number that is? Where he takes
on mine, it's right around line 20. Of course, I'm using a slightly different translation, so...
So that is something to mention, is that if you're tracking with other people in translations, is that the Fagel's edition is numbered according to his translation, not numbered according to the original Greek. And so it doesn't quite match up sometimes if you're reading in a group and people have Latimer or was yours Green?
Green.
You said Green?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think the next thing that sort of stood out to me.
Oh, yeah, there it is. Yeah. It's like 25 or so for us on Fagel's.
Was that the sea beasts all recognize Poseidon, which I suppose isn't too surprising, except that not all people recognize the gods. And so I thought there's just an interesting interplay there that the animals seem to have a more intuitive recognition of the gods than men do.
That's really interesting. Yeah, the nature, because even nature as a whole, right? The animals, but also like the sea obeys, it heaved in joy, cleaving a path for him.
Yeah.
Right.
Little bitty notes as well. He hobbles his horses so they don't run off.
Yeah. That'd be embarrassing. Here comes the sea god in all your grandeur and then your horses run off.
Yeah, so I think there's some stuff there, and also if someone had greater background in it than I do, I would imagine that there's depths to be drawn out of stuff like that. What relationship? What does that mean regarding, say, Poseidon's power?
I have a murky memory that horses are actually tied to the sea and to Poseidon,
interesting.
And those are his gifts. I could be wrong there. I have some note in mythology on that. So Poseidon. One thing too to mention. About Poseidon that I found interesting is, you know, Hera tempts him earlier. If you remember whatever book that was, right? Hera cannot stand.
To enter. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's like telling, like she tempts Poseidon, says, hey, you should enter the battle. And he is very much, he has none of it, right? He's just like, nope, I have, like, why would I war against Zeus? Why would you do that? And that's where she goes and tempts Athena. Athena responds and then Zeus cuts her off and kind of chastises both of the women. But I found Poseidon interesting here because Zeus looks away and he just comes storming in. In a certain way, we'll see. I mean, he very much, maybe because he gets, I don't think he gets distracted or maybe whatever it is, but like he's not doing really even like a sneak attack. It's not like he just jumps in, does something and jumps out.
No, he sticks around. And
so I wasn't quite sure on how to track the change in his attitude. I mean, on its surface level, I think you can just say, listen, Zeus isn't paying attention. He's going to get it while it's good.
Mm-hmm.
But as the narrative folds out, he seems to change his disposition.
Well, I think, and I don't want to leap too far into the book, but there's also a sense in which you can understand the the combatants here as caught between Poseidon and Zeus. And another that Poseidon himself seems to hint at about them being caught between Achilles and Agamemnon. So there's an idea, too, of this on a mortal level and on an immortal level of people being almost strangled between these titanic wills.
No, yeah, I agree. We saw a lot of that earlier, too, right, where the gods were actually fighting on both sides and men were just being crushed right in the middle. So kind of pushing us along, so Poseidon comes down. He takes the form of Calchas the prophet, right? There's some irony, right? He's talking to the two Ajaxes, the Aeantes, and he's like, oh, but if only a god can make you both powerful, right? And then he, yeah, just wink, wink, nod, nod, and then he does it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too, as we kind of track the ability of the human capacity to understand the divine, little Ajax understands that that was actually Poseidon, where giant Ajax has to be told. And once he's told, he understands and he kind of sees.
It's like, me too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I just think Ajax's relationship to the divine, I think, is worth noting because he seems in a lot of ways to represent somewhat of a natural character. He's often butting up against people who have been blessed by the gods, right? But he kind of just seems to be this raw strength.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here he's blessed by Poseidon, but then again, all the Argives are blessed by Poseidon in this narrative.
Yeah, and you don't see the gods intervene on his behalf very often. I guess this is one of those cases where they do, but mostly he seems to be presented as a sort of natural perfection, right? That he doesn't really require their aid. But in a weird way, that would also set him slightly outside of their providence as well.
Yeah, I just think there's something to note there. And keep in mind that, you know, even Homer tells us that he is the second greatest warrior on the Achaeans under Achilles. So not Diomedes, not others. But as it opens in the opening narrative, right, he's number two. So we kind of move along. Poseidon is, I would say, kind of stirring up the Argives now to fight. It's interesting, Poseidon's commentary on Achilles, this is around like 140, he says, "That worthless coward who cringes from fighting, but you, I round on you with all my heart. Weaklings, you make the crisis worse," right? At any moment with this hanging back. So it's an interesting critique on the Argives. I think Poseidon is noting what I think Homer has been showing us too, which is the Argives could take Troy without Achilles.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They could take him. And Poseidon seems somewhat frustrated in this capacity. So they reform. You get around like 150. You get them basically forming into a phalanx to stop the Trojan charge.
I will rewind just slightly, though, because I think it's Ajax talking. I'm trying to... and he, strictly speaking, blames Agamemnon for what's going wrong. Like, I think this is one of the first times he said...
Yeah, it's around like 127, I think-ish.
I just think that's an interesting aside that gets tossed in. In this translation, is it... In truth, that the person at fault is Atreus' heroic son, wide-ruling Agamemnon. So he's blaming Agamemnon for much of their woes.
Oh, I see here, yeah. This one talks about our leader's weakness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Because of our leader's weakness and our troops' lack of discipline.
Right. And yeah, because he spurned the famous runner Achilles.
So that's Poseidon speaking.
Is it Poseidon?
Yeah, it's the monologue. I mean, unless I'm mistaken, but the monologue starts around... 110,
yeah.
And he's kind of giving this speech.
Oh, you're right.
To rally them.
Well, then I thought it was Poseidon at first, and then I clicked back to see because mine's on an ebook. But yeah, you're right. That's Poseidon.
Yeah, I mean, still, it's still quite notable, right? And he's taking, also just you know using the term "our," right,
yeah,
is interesting.
That's what threw me for a second as well. But that's interesting as well because he's specifically blaming Agamemnon, and I guess one of the questions would be, is he speaking the truth? As a rule, actually, the gods do speak the truth, although not always. Or is he just trying to rally people?
Well, I'm not really sure if I'm going to muster a defense of Agamemnon at the moment. I mean, he seems to be an incredibly weak leader, right? Very much driven by his passions. You see him change. How many times has he already tried to retreat? Right, or actually just give up. Mm-hmm. Sometimes testing them in, then sometimes actually falling into his own despair.
Pretty disastrous test in its case, though, as
right.
well. Yeah, in that sense, you know, if Agamemnon, I guess what I was saying, is in, if that would be a commentary within the text itself that would affirm that the criticism of Agamemnon that, you know, we all see when we read this is consistent internally as well. Like, it's an internal, it's not just some accidental critique or something about the culture as we read it now, but within the text itself.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, then, sometimes we've talked about is Homer trying to teach us something about the gods? Because as much as I think he's clearly critiqued Agamemnon and show him as this capricious leader that goes back and forth and et cetera, you know, keep in mind Odysseus's comment, right? That the kings are close to the gods, right? They nurse their rage. And so there's like this, you know, how different is Agamemnon from some of the gods in their own, just like, you know, they go back and forth, they can't make up their mind, right? They're somewhat chaotic. So there's, I think it's an interesting point about whether a critique of Agamemnon backs into a critique of the gods themselves. All right, so let's see. We'll push forward. So about 170. Let's see. We get
some momentum shift.
Yeah, we get some Hector coming in. We get a lot of face smashing and things like this. Teucer, I think, actually uses a spear. So that's just notable because he's been a archer the whole time. Hector is apparently also, so we get another Ajax-Hector battle. And I didn't know whether to read this literally. I think so, just because of how many times they've fought. But down around like 225 or 27 or so, it says Hector's whole body was cased in tremendous bronze, right? They could not pierce his skin. So I didn't know if they were talking about his actual armor, or the gods have basically enveloped him and like he just simply cannot be pierced. I took it more as the latter, just simply how many times. Really. Yeah, I took it just that he just really cannot be pierced right now, mainly because I don't find that any more miraculous than anything else they've already done for Hector, if that makes sense.
I just feel like, you know, in a video game, whenever you die and then you come back and you have better armor, so that way you can try to beat the boss. And it's like, oh, well, I'll try this one out.
Mm-hmm.
He just keeps dying and then coming back and
right
having more better armor.
There's a slight comparison here where around 240, there is a question here whether the carnage in the Iliad increases as the book goes on, like the depravity of the violence. I think there's a pretty strong argument that that's true. We get here that Poseidon quaked in anger because his grandson was brought down in the bloody charge. So in the middle of the battle, Poseidon loses his son. There's an interesting contrast. I can't remember if it's in, I think it is in this book, where one of Ares' sons dies, and Ares is aloof in Olympus and has no idea it's even occurred, right? And so you get this kind of interesting comparison between Poseidon, who's down there working, and Ares, who at the moment, he will, but at the moment isn't even aware that one of his own progeny has actually died.
Well, I mean, not that we needed too many reminders of it at this point anyway, but it's a reminder of the limitations of the gods, that if their attention can be drawn elsewhere, they can...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is a major premise of this book, right? Zeus is looking elsewhere. Yeah, they're very much beings inside of creation, right? As powerful as they are, they're still kind of beings inside creation. Which I think is an interesting distinction, particularly for a pantheon. So we get, Idomeneus, we get their, he has spears. We look for a practical use of loot. We notice that his whole hut is full of Trojan spears, right, that he can actually hand out to those who break their own. Just a lot of back and forth that we kind of captured in the opening narrative. You do get, down at 400, you get the two powerful sons of Cronos, Zeus and Poseidon, their deathless spirits warring against each other. So this is what you were talking earlier about, Thomas, that the mortals somewhat get crushed between the two divine wills coming together. Zeus willing a Trojan victory, Hector's victory, lifting the famous runner Achilles' glory higher, but he had no lust to destroy the whole Argive force before the walls of Troy. All the father wanted was the glory for Thetis and Thetis' strong-willed son. But Poseidon, surging in secret out of the gray surf, went driving the Argive ranks and lashed them on. So you get this kind of crushing between the two. There's a funny part.
Can I
please jump in.
Let me jump in real quick just to make a case for great Ajax. once again. Because around like 375, at the very very top of page 352, it talks about when it comes to men, great Ajax yields to no one. You know, so like here you have, again, I mean, I don't want to make the case. I'm keeping my mind open, but you've had Hector at times see certain people in battle and say, yeah, I'm going to go the other way, or I'm right. not going in. You have great Ajax here who's saying, like, hey, listen, it doesn't matter who you are. Or,
I'm in.
Or,
yeah.
I mean, he's, like we said in the last book, a glutton for war, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. for battle.
Yeah.
No, I just had to.
Well, I think you could couple that, too, with the idea that a lot of times we see that great Ajax only retreats at the will of Zeus. Right, so there's several points.
He has to be dragged back out, mm-hmm. practically.
Right.
Yeah, there are several points in which he will only retreat if Zeus's will becomes explicit.
Now, I don't want to skip ahead too much, so I don't want to... I may be going ahead, but is this the book where we see Ajax also become increasingly... increasing in his taunting of others, though? Like, they'll, you know... at one point, someone dies, and I hope I'm not skipping a book, and he starts saying, well, I think... he looks familiar, you know, and mocking about his taking him back to his family and stuff like that. All I'm going to say to that is, whether that's here or elsewhere, or there seems to be Ajax as well as others seem to be taking a turn for an increasing level of violence. I mean, there's no more, you know, nice parting of the ways. We'll bury each other nicely as between the last duel of Hector and Ajax.
Yeah, I think, yeah. I think that the Trojan push against the Argive ships has changed a lot of the dynamics of the war, mm-hmm. I think. Around 440, you might remember Agamemnon's sacrifice of his own daughter,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's interesting, Homer never actually mentions that narrative, but seems to play off of it several times because his audience understands it. So you'll see here that Adamaneus here actually mocks one of the Trojans who, you know, he was going to get married and he had to come out here and fight in Troy and et cetera. And he talks about like, oh, well, we just, you know, we wouldn't have asked that much of you. We would have let you marry one of Agamemnon's daughters, which on its face sounds great until you kind of realize how that works.
Where that's going.
You know, our price for our brides are not so quite killing. So there's like this ongoing joke.
That's a great example, though, in general as well, as far as something about the brutality going up. I mean, adversaries, but not necessarily cruelty, is switching into a brutality and cruelty that didn't exist there before.
Our boy Aeacus dies, if you remember him. Remember from
482 or so?
Yeah. So he finally bites it. And so, if you remember right, he was the one that like sent his chariot crashing into the rampart and called Zeus a liar.
For what it's worth, I was certain he was going to die in the last book. Because
he made it longer than what we thought after his antics.
Yeah, he calls Zeus a liar. How long do you last?
And the narrative calls him a fool a couple times, you know. And so I guess he the comeuppance finally caught up with him. But he did last longer than I expected.
Yeah, he is... once you basically blaspheme against Zeus, your capacity to live is probably diminished.
Although funny enough, Zeus doesn't interfere to do that. I know. It's like it's just like it happens at least when he's doing something else. Right? Yeah.
I thought it was gonna be like a horrific death.
Yeah. Actually, I must admit that actually I thought he had erred so bad last time that I realized that I just assumed he died. And actually, when I saw his name here, I had to go back and look in Fagles and be like, wait, are there two of these guys? Like, what? who is this guy?
I had the same...
Nope, he's still here. But, I mean, he does suffer somewhat of a brutal death. Maybe not the worst we've seen, right? But a spearhead punched his gullet under his chin, and the bronze point went ripping through his nape, and down the Trojan fell as an oak or white poplar falls.
Yeah, he doesn't get the title, though, of the worst battle wound, which will be in this book.
I think somewhere I have a memory of someone trying to remember where that imagery was used, an oak or as a white poplar falls. Mm. It's used here. It's also used elsewhere later on.
Book 16, 15, 16, somewhere.
Somewhere I remember someone was in our small group was actually searching for where that phrase had been used before.
Well, I think it had been used as well, funny enough, for the the two defending the gates, but not as falling, but as an oak or poplar like stands. So it's like opposite. You know, I'd have to go back and double check that. But they're I think they're compared to trees, but in a solid sense rather than a toppling sense.
Mm-hmm. So let's see. We get more of the phalanxes. Aeneas comes back into the narrative around like 530. They actually it's interesting. Homer says they actually find him standing idle. And so I don't, because
what's he been up to since he got dropped, you know?
I mean, he's been somewhat absent from the narrative. So he comes back. He says,
being idle, his, I don't know.
Yeah, on the fringe of battle, standing idle forever, angered at Priam, who always scrimped his honors, brave as Aeneas was among the Trojan fighters.
Would that mean he's playing the Achilles of the Trojans?
Yeah, he's just like sitting there in rage and pity.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting because it also didn't quite match my imprint of who Aeneas is in the text. But anyway, I found it notable that he's just kind of sitting back there. So we get another forming of phalanxes. They're fighting around Alcathous's corpse, right? So we get one of these other little scrums, if you will, these fighting over the corpse. And so, which is a theme that we've been picking up on, right, of how important it is to bury the dead. You know, the other side wants to mutilate the dead and what it means to not have your proper burial rites.
I mean, and we're not that far off where they took a whole day to properly bury on both sides.
Correct. Right. 605 or so, just for the record, is where Ares has not heard about his son has died yet. So there's a little bit of a comparison there between Poseidon and Ares as far as their progeny dying and who's actually paying attention and who is not. So, let's see. I also like the way it's blue-haired Poseidon. That's at like 651.
Yeah.
It's an interesting picture. And then we get, just for the record, because of all the wounds that we get in the Iliad, Homer actually tells us the worst one that the god of battle deals to wretched men. And this is the poor guy that gets speared between the genitals and the navel. A hideous wound, the worst the god of battles deals to wretched men.
Mm.
Which, obviously, choosing points to be speared.
That's not one I'd want.
No. I took this one, though, as it is a slow death, right? It's not vital. You're going to die just because, like, you know, once you rip all that open, like, there's no putting that all back together. And
no.
All your, you know, insides and stuff are leaking out, and it's just a terrible, slow death.
Now, is there any hint as to why that death was visited on him specifically?
Yeah, so I thought that this could actually be more of a retribution because the guy who I believe dies is Aeacus's son.
Yeah, I was thinking of that too.
So whether that's actually retribution for his earlier blasphemy.
That is interesting. I took it more as just a device in order because the battle's going on. Like, the reason why things are getting more and more graphic is also probably because their audience, like, you got to keep the audience's attention. You know, like, so...
Right.
You know, like...
This is the oral poem. They've already had their dinner, and you're right, having, like, to keep them awake.
Well, there is at least one tradition that this was normally recited over the course of 3 days. So the question is, where would you break that up?
Right.
Because there's 24 books, you could say just 8 books a day, but it doesn't. They're not equal length, so it probably doesn't really work out that way.
Yeah.
The better question is, how do they have the attention span to listen to the same story for 3 full days?
Well, they weren't habituated to staring at everything for 10 seconds.
Unless if you keep stabbing people.
You keep eyeballs popping out. And
yeah.
There's an interesting note. Menelaus fights the prophet Helenus, as we kind of opened in our opening narrative. There, but down below that, I just want to point...
Where are you?
This is 690.
Okay.
A little bit below 690. I want to point out just a little bit of a tense and perspective change, just because it's subtle here, but then it comes in pretty heavily, is Homer speaks to Menelaus directly, right? Which is an interesting kind of shift in the narrative. So it talks about, you know, Menelaus famed in arms, but a grim fate was rushing him to the stroke of death to be crushed in this hell of war by you, Menelaus, just as the two men closed heading into each other. So it's interesting that he talks, he uses that you language, right, and actually talks directly to Menelaus. It's subtle here, but then we'll see it kind of gets ratcheted up later in the Iliad. And I think there's a good question as to why. Like, why is there a certain level of intimacy that Homer expresses towards, like, different characters?
And I think we'll see this more later, but usually that would draw you towards someone who is in some position of weakness. And that's the opposite in this case, because Menelaus has the victory.
Correct. Yeah. Menelaus, I think, also, just as far as, like, people that can see the will of Zeus down at, like, 7:30, he seems to be painfully aware that all the brutal carnage comes from Zeus,
mm-hmm.
right? He's painfully aware of why, you know, they're being pushed back. Remember, Menelaus, you have to keep track of all the oaths and promises and everything that's happened, and Menelaus has been promised by Hera, and maybe Athena as well, that, you know, he's going to walk the streets of Troy. Mm-hmm. So he knows that, and he's holding on to that. And so he realizes, well, maybe the reason that's not happening now is because the will of Zeus is pushing back, and we have to go through this carnage first. Speaking of carnage, on 7:50, you get, so this goes into the increasing violence slash keeping people awake during dinner time theory. At 7:50, a guy gets speared right through the buttocks and pierced through the bladder.
Oh, that one's a rough one again.
And it then talks about him grasping out his life as he writhed along the ground like an earthworm stretched out in death. Just a.
What does yours say?
It says, and like a worm lay stretched there on the ground, his dark blood ran, soaked the earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have the dark blood phrase. So, anyway, just continuing violence. I mean, if you talk about, if you have to write a book and about 300 people die in it, you guys start getting really creative about how you
how they're dying. Yep.
I think my favorite, maybe we should take a break and talk about our favorite deaths in the Iliad. The one that I was reading and was like, this is where I'm like, Homer, did you channel like your 14-year-old boy like to come up with this? Where is it Agamemnon that cuts off the guy's head and arms?
Yeah, and he rolled.
He cuts off his arms, and it says he sends him rolling through the carnage like a log, right? And it's like, what are you kidding? Like, this is it. Like, can you imagine a movie trying to, like, capture that moment and take itself seriously?
Yeah.
Right?
I'm still waiting for, like, some kind of, and maybe I've missed it, but at some point, one of them get mortally, like, wounded, but a slow death, and, like, the next day, they're like, oh, you're still here? Like, you're still around? Like,
right.
We thought he killed you yesterday.
Yeah. I'm waiting for that to happen.
Thomas, yeah. Do you have any specific deaths question. That stick in your mind?
I do have some specific deaths that list in my mind. I don't think I can mention them yet, though.
Mm. Oh, they're secret future deaths?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's an interesting parallel that pops up a little after 7:60. Insofar as we get a individual who gets to choose his fate, which is somewhat paralleled to Achilles. So his are not so great. He either is going to die in the halls of his father of a plague, or he's going to go with the ships and die at Trojan hands. And so he just decides to die fighting against Troy. But it's just simply worth flagging that here's, as we kind of track the theme of fate and how it enacts and kind of imprints onto humanity, here's another person who, like Achilles, actually was able to give some decision of how their fate would actually play out.
Now, is there, I didn't have a chance to look into this, but is there an explanation as to how he became aware of his fate? Because we know that about Achilles. We're told how he became aware of his, at least I don't know if we're told in the Iliad, but we're told in mythology in general. But
so in this one, his father is a prophet, and it says his father told him. So for Achilles, it would be Thetis, right, the god. So it does seem like the ability to choose your fate is a gift from the gods. So this one's channeled through a prophet. The other one's channeled through Thetis, who's a, you know, divine sea nymph.
And didn't he die from Paris?
That'd be embarrassing.
I think so. I think like 775 or so, suddenly Paris struck him under the jaw and ear, and the life flew from his limbs.
I might have chosen the plague.
Yeah, I mean, that's like for all of humanity now, you get killed by Paris.
Yeah, that's not
that. Out of everybody, I think that would be the person I would want to, like, I would not want to die from.
Oh. Yeah.
At least at this point.
No spoilers. Did he know? Oh yeah, he looked at
I don't have any spoilers yet.
He looked at.
I haven't read this.
Yeah, this is Adam's first time through the text. if Adam starts giving out spoilers, I'm going to be intrigued.
So it's prophecy.
Right. Prophecy. All right. What else do we have?
Around a little after 8:10, I thought it was really cool that little Ajax shows like loyalty to big Ajax. You know, so at the end of last book, big Ajax gives kind of a command to little Ajax, like, you stay here, we're gonna go. And little Ajax is like loyal to him. He's like, yeah, absolutely. And here again, little Ajax is loyal to big Ajax.
You know, there's really, I think we've talked about this before, but just as like how people get, you know, thrown into immortality through their fame in this text, there's nothing to show that little Ajax is actually a little man.
Right.
He's only little because the other Ajax is a giant. A mountain.
Yeah.
Right. And so you get known as little Ajax. I mean,
like, he's like 6'5", right. You know.
James the Lesser,
right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. He's just like, well, you know, you if you just would have had a different name, you could have been,
I'm
you know, Ajax
every
the
other
Great.
Man on the battlefield except for this one dude.
And so we share right the around here. We may have gone just past it. We get another back and forth between Hector and Paris as well, where Paris is out of the battle again for a bit, and Hector starts kind of rebuking him for this yet again. He's like, no, no, this time I really was fighting. In fact, I was just about to go fight again.
Oh, yeah, that's coming up.
Yeah, so.
Just a few notes before we see that. Around 8:30, for those who are more interested in like the tactics, we get I noticed that we actually get this a group tactic description of fighting, right? Men in heavy armor up in the front. While they actually fought with the Trojans, while then there's this other group slung from the rear out of range, right? Slung there being like slings, I believe, right? So you actually have in like showering arrows down. So you actually get like heavy armor in the front, arrows in the back, a little bit more of strategic structured warfare than Homer actually usually gives us insights to. For whatever reason, when we get closer to the ships, he seems to talk about this more and more. Right, they're forming phalanxes, they're forming these strategies. You know, I'm sure we could discern some type of reason why that's actually occurring. Maybe just because, you know, through all these duels, we've been introduced to most of the characters. But there is more insights into actually how this works. Polydamas gives some advice to Hector, right? And, you know, he's kind of we were calling him the Nestor, right, of the
Little
Trojans.
Nestor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, little Nestor.
Little Nestor.
I like that. Little Nestor. Nestor Light. And so just our advice without all the personal stories. So this one actually wins Hector over, and obviously his advice is like, we need to regroup.
Credit to Hector, you know, for having some right. humility to listen to him, you know, and say, because mm-hmm. you know, we've seen Agamemnon not do that. And what?
Well, we've seen Hector not do that once.
We've already seen Hector do that once. So credit where credit's due.
Right. But then we get into what you were mentioning, Thomas, is actually the kind of dialogue back and forth between Paris and Hector. I actually love it when Hector rips into Paris because the critiques are just wonderful, right? This is like a little bit before 890. Paris, appalling Paris, our prince of beauty, mad for women. You lure them all to ruin, right? And Paris actually, though, tries to actually push back here and is like, hey, by the way, our comrades are all dead. Hector, right? He's actually holding this section of the line as Hector's trying to go around and regroup all the Trojan warlords. And Hector actually comes to understand, if I remember right, like how much of a carnage has actually been on that side of the fighting. So
it would have been nice to know some of these guys that ended up dying, like have a little bit of their backstory. Like if they were like a big warrior, you know, for them, it would have been nice to know about them. Because all we know is Hector and Aeneas, and I mean, we don't know very many.
Yeah.
Unlike the Greeks.
The kind of coming to the close of the text, you see something that I would imagine Homer is doing quite intentionally around 9:20, which it says, just last morning, but now great Zeus incited all-out war. Down the Trojans came like a squall of brawling gale winds, blasting down with a father's thunder. Yeah. Loosed on earth in a superhuman uproar bursts as they pound the heavy seas, the giant breakers seething, battle lines of them roaring, shoulders rearing, exploding foam, waves in the vanguard.
Yeah, I have that highlighted as well for two reasons, and I was going to ask you about this, because It says, and now Zeus stirred. So Zeus is back. Did I miss it? Or is this the line when Zeus's attention returns?
He's back.
Yeah, I don't know if it... no, it's a good observation about, like, what do we say about Hector? It doesn't seem, though, that... Because when Zeus finally kind of turns around and pays attention, he seems to do so with, I think, some attention. But...
Well, the mix of the air and sea imagery is also interesting because we have a conflict here to some extent between Zeus and Poseidon. Mm.
Yeah, that's why I had flagged it, is because, you know, you get the Trojans characterized by being a squall, thunder, and that they're pounding the seas, and they're pounding the Achaeans, who are supported by Poseidon. So I think we get these extended similes, right, from Homer. And here we see him playing with the imagery based off Zeus and Poseidon and their sides in the war. It ends again with Ajax and Hector having this kind of back and forth. Ajax gives basically an unintentional prophecy, right? This is after 940. He ends, you know, hey, we're going to watch all of you run back to Troy, right? Whipping dust from the plain to sweep you back to Troy. And as he says this, right, a bird sign comes again. So we get another bird sign, this omen. The Argives cheer. And then Hector actually taunts back, which I thought was interesting, right? So he's kind of trying to come over the top despite the bird sign. And then basically we just see that it says, you know, it talks about that Zeus sets them up for more carnage as the book ends.
Hector says something interesting right at the end. He says, I wish I were the son of Zeus, of the Aegis, all my days, and it was the lady Hera who bore me, and I was honored as our Athena and Apollo. I wonder to what extent that is him acknowledging that he's not, or, as it were, an impermissible kind of reaching out towards the divine.
Yeah, that's a good question. What do you think the purpose of Book 13 is? Like, in the plot?
That's like an excellent question.
Do we have, like, I'm kind of pointing out my own ignorance here. I just, I'm kind of exploring.
Could you have skipped from 12 to 14, and what would you have lost?
Yeah, what would you have lost?
Is an interesting question.
No major character dies, right? I mean, we get, I guess, a little bit of a plot structure of Zeus not paying attention, so Poseidon gets to step in. I mean, that
could be established other ways. I do think the tension between Zeus and Poseidon is an important point. I don't know that it needed to be stretched at this length. If you're just like, you know, one hesitates to be Homer's like literary critic, right? But at the or editor,
it's over, yeah,
right.
Yeah,
but it's a pacing question. Like, to take it in movie terms, like,
the reason I ask is because I think that, you know, we've pushed here on Ascend, the Great Books podcast, that the true teacher, right, is Homer. That's who we're actually addressing, right? That we're just kind of all students of Homer in different capacities. And so, you know, who I critique is me, right? Yeah. I'm not seeing something, right? Something's not here. I found the book to be, like I said, I think it's my least favorite book. I mean, I even looked book two more. That gives the whole, like, here's where everyone is, and here's all the tribes that, you know.
At least the opening of book two is very engaging.
Yeah, I mean, some of that, you know, like we've said, has all the charm of a biblical genealogy. But the thing is, on that one, I knew its purpose. I was like, okay, the reason we're getting all this is because Homer's showing a Greek unity, that all the Greek tribes and chieftains finally were unified under this common bind to come get Helen. And obviously then that whole culture takes on that name, right, this Hellenistic culture. I just don't, you know, I read it twice. I think I might have just missed exactly what the actual, like, underpinning is here outside of Poseidon entering. But it doesn't give structure to the whole book. It's really just kind of a
note. I think Poseidon entering, to me, the major theme of Poseidon entering is not just that he enters. We've seen gods enter and affect one side or the other. But the theme, perhaps, to an extent there, of seeing men simply caught and crushed between the gods.
Right. Yeah, there's slightly fatalistic.
And again, this balance of seeing something at least analogous, but on the lower level of men being caught and crushed between the will of two great men, Achilles and Agamemnon.
Correct. Yeah, no, there's a lot of parallels there.
So beyond that, I would say that was the main thing I got out of book 13, is just those two parallels. Mm-hmm. There's probably a lot more there, though, but that's the one I got.
Well, if you're screaming right now at us, like listening in the car, saying how obvious we're missing something, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know, so that way we can...
You can find Adam on Twitter, yeah. And you can stream at him. Be like, hey,
here's
dumb.
His email.
Right. And then I'll be like, oh, yeah, I put that in the guide. I forgot about that point. Yeah. Which you can keep in mind that you can go on our website and find the guide question and answer format and kind of lead you through the mystery that is Homer. Well, Adam, Thomas, any other comments, critiques?
No.
Nope.
That's good, because book 14, which we'll do next week, is actually one of my favorite texts in the entire Iliad.
So you go from one of your least favorite, or your least favorite, mm-hmm. to one of your favorite.
Yeah, and once we dig into 14, then you probably have some questions of who I am as a person, once we get the subject matter of what actually happens in book 14, but we'll play that out.
All right, well, we'll see you guys next week.
All right.